If it's Wednesday, President Biden gets a firsthand look at the scale of the hurricane devastation on Florida's Gulf Coast as the disaster brings together opposing forces to cope with the aftermath of the storm. Plus, October surprise, the Herschel Walker bombshell reverberates across the midterms. We'll get fresh reaction from Republican voters and lawmakers. And human rights protests grow across Iran as the regime intensifies its violent crackdown against the movement. Welcome to Meet the Press Now. I'm Kristen Welker. President Biden is on the ground in Florida this hour as the state struggles to recover from Hurricane Ian's devastation. He met with Florida Republican Governor Ron DeSantis, the two putting aside political differences to help the people of Florida. DeSantis even praising the Biden administration's help in the recovery effort.
We were very fortunate to have good coordination with the White House and with FEMA from the very beginning of this. We declared a state of emergency last Friday, September 23rd. This was a disturbance out there by Columbia. And then the next day, we got a major disaster declaration approved by the president, and we really appreciated that. And that basically set off the massive mobilization that we had ready to be able to respond to this storm.
The president has also been speaking with local officials and business owners and touring the damage in hard-hit Fort Myers. He pledged the administration's continued assistance.
We're here today because we wanted to tell you in person that we're thinking of you and we're not leaving. We're not leaving until this gets done. I promise you that. And it's going to take a lot of time, not weeks or months. It's going to take years for everything to get squared away in the state of Florida to fully recover and rebuild.
Years, he says. There have been 107 confirmed deaths in Florida and 5 in North Carolina since Ian made landfall 1 week ago. Southwest Florida faces a long road to recovery. More than 200,000 Floridians are still without power, and thousands remain in emergency shelters after their homes were damaged or destroyed. FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell estimated the cost of the recovery efforts would be in the billions, saying it could be, quote, one of the more costly disasters we've seen in many years. This morning, President Biden announced the administration was amending the disaster declaration to allow for an increase in federal funding to deal with all of this. Joining me now to discuss this is NBC News White House correspondent, my colleague, Mike Memoli, and from Fort Myers, Florida, correspondent Shaquille Brewster. Thanks so much to both of you. Mike, I want to start off with you and what we just heard from President Biden. He was just speaking after touring the damage there in Florida. Of course, he was meeting with business owners as well as residents. What was his key message today, Mike?
Well, Kristen, it really has been remarkable as you and I are covering this administration how often he has had to travel across this country to talk about these extreme weather events, whether it's wildfires out west, tornadoes in Kentucky, flooding in the Northeast, and of course now Hurricane Ian and the devastation it wrought in Florida. And you don't want to say these visits have gotten to create some of a routine, but there has been sort of a familiarity to the visit. But there were some notable moments as we were watching the president in Florida today. One of the sort of routine announcements the president has been making as he visits these communities hard hit by storms is that the federal government will reimburse the state, the local governments, for 100% of the recovery costs for up to 60 days. And so the president making that same announcement today, but then he actually turned to Governor Ron DeSantis, a Republican, a potential future opponent. And he said, actually, after talking to the governor today, we may need to extend that even further. And the governor nodded. And I think that really spoke to the, as Biden later put it, hand in glove cooperation that we're seeing between these two men that has been so significant. Ron DeSantis, of course, on the ballot this November, but considering a future presidential bid, Biden was supposed to travel to Florida last week to campaign with DeSantis's appointment. But again today, highlighting the degree to which these two men are willing to work together, want to work together for the people of Florida. And Biden using some pretty significant language in describing at one point what he called the Titanic effect of this storm, something that obviously is going to leave a mark with him as he goes back to Washington and looks now toward the future rebuilding costs for so many of these communities.
Yeah, and Mike, obviously we cover the optics of a trip like this so closely between the president, between Governor DeSantis, the two making it very clear they're putting politics aside for today, as you just were reporting. I want to switch gears a little bit and talk about the other big news that the White House has been focused on today, that announcement by OPEC announcing it would cut oil production by 2 million barrels today, which could potentially lead to an increase in the price of oil globally, including here in the U.S. The White House had a pretty strong response, Mike. What are they saying?
Yeah, obviously, this news is very much unwelcome by the White House. A statement earlier today from Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, and also Brian Deese, the head of the National Economic Council, calling this news disappointing. You heard the president himself as he was leaving the White House to head to Florida, saying it was concerning. He didn't think it was justified. And this is a White House that, as we are now less than 5 weeks away from the midterm elections, knows that there's a real correlation between voter attitudes and the price of gas. You'll remember a few months ago when gas hit the record $5 a gallon. Obviously, it has since subsided, and we saw what happened after that. Democratic fortunes improving. And so the White House certainly concerned about this and on a foreign policy level, also concerned about the global impact, the global economy, and what that might mean in terms of ripple effects here for the U.S. economy at home.
Absolutely. And we know a lot of White House officials say that gas price is one of their top priorities, making sure that they continue to go down. So this is really unwelcome news. Shaq, I want to turn to you now. You obviously are there in Florida. Let's go back to the actual visit by President Biden today. What has the reaction been from folks there on the ground? Have they heard from the president what they've wanted to? Do they feel like they're getting the support they need from the federal government?
I'll tell you, Kristen, many people didn't even realize the president was coming, or they ran into the traffic that some of the motorcade and shutdown caused in this area, because much of their priority is recovering and responding to the disaster, what's going on in their daily lives. Some of them don't even have connection to the internet, so they weren't even aware that he was in town. But, you know, one thing that I'm hearing at this disaster recovery center, one of the FEMA sites that have been set up, by the way, the president announced that three more of these such sites will be set up. One thing that you're seeing here is just how widespread the impact is. You have at this location insurance companies here. You have FEMA. That's where you see some of the longest lines, people waiting more than an hour to meet with a FEMA representative to see how to file a claim. What are the next steps they should follow? And then you also have some state agencies here. It's very clear that so many people need help, and it's not just the people along the coast. It's people really all across this entire community. So one thing I've been asking is, with the president being here, what is your message to him? What should he be seeing while he's here on the ground? Listen to a few of those responses.
And just basically try to, you know, get us gone, take care of our property, that we are at a total loss for everything, you know. Just some help to get through all this.
If he doesn't shed a few himself, I'd be surprised, you know. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And I think, you know, I think he has compassion, you know. I also think, you know, Governor DeSantis is doing a great job.
You know, Mike was just talking about how we're seeing so many of these disasters, so it's not becoming routine, but there is somewhat of a cadence that is building here. And, you know, one thing that we see is it's about this period after a storm where people stop focusing on the here and now of an emergency reaction of how do I get food? How do I get water? But then they start realizing, oh, where do I need to live? I'm staying at a friend's house. That's not sustainable. What do I need to do next? And that is something that many people are coming to right now and coming to FEMA with help for those answers on what should they do in the mid to long term. How do they become whole again? Many of those rescues are no longer happening. It's more recovery missions, especially along the Fort Myers Beach area. So many people trying to see what to do next now that the immediate after storm, the immediate aftermath of the storm is clear, and they want to know how they're going to live the rest of their lives.
Yeah, and Shaq, so good to hear from those people there, to actually have those interviews that you got. I really appreciate it. Finally, very quickly before I let you go, I just want to follow up with you. Can you give us the very latest on the search and recovery efforts?
Well, it's still ongoing. I mean, Fort Myers Beach, where we saw the president today speaking with the Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, that is still closed for the most part to civilians. That's because FEMA teams are going house to house, still making sure that any body is being recovered right now. Anyone that was lost in that storm, that those bodies are being recovered. And that's why you're unfortunately seeing that death toll continue to rise. But there is some positive news here. The governor announced today that Pine Island, one of the islands where it's been completely cut off, where people have had to go to boat to get to because the main bridge collapsed. Well, that bridge, a temporary fix, has been completed today. So residents will be able to start approaching that area again. Senegal Island, where there's the causeway is completely shut off and it was destroyed during the hurricane. The governor saying that a contract has been awarded. So that will be done by the end of the month. So there are signs of improvement that you're seeing here, but still so much work left to be done.
That is for sure. The president saying it could take years. Shaq Brewster, thank you for your great reporting on the ground. And Mike Memoli beforehand. Joining me now is Brian Nagel, the general manager of three businesses in Fort Myers Beach that were destroyed in the storm. Thank you so much, Brian, for joining me. I am so sorry for everything that you and your family and your friends have been through down there.
Yeah, thank you, Kristen. It really is. It's very, very sad.
Bring us up to speed, Brian.
The station is, yeah, go ahead.
How are you? How are your employees doing?
My employees, we are all accounted for, thankfully. It's just some of them lost not just their job with the restaurant being completely destroyed, but a lot of them lost their homes on top of that. I got a lot of calls that all they had left were the clothes on their back at that point. So we have a donation site set up right now, and the community has been absolutely amazing. And everybody really is coming together and helping as much as they can. We do have our website, www.shuckersfmb.com, with a donor box link, doing fundraising for our employees that will go all to the employees. And just another note as far as, you know, I know that we were talking about the president and Governor DeSantis working well together, which is great and all. But I just wish during some of these visits, whether it be the president today, the governor yesterday, it needs to be done a little bit more quietly, because it completely shut down our site. There was traffic lines with thousands of cars where people were sitting for 40 minutes. They could not they don't have access to gasoline right now. Yeah. And it's just something that I wanted to point out. You know, a lot of people here trying to do a lot of good work, and that really messed us up for a large part of the day.
Yeah. Well, and it's important to get all those points out, Brian. I'm curious to follow up with you. Do you feel like you are getting the support that you need to help start the rebuilding process from the state, from the federal government?
I don't know if we're there quite yet as far as even the rebuilding process. You know, right now, just like you said, it's just still recovery. This is finding homes for the people, just a place to sleep for the people that lost their homes, making sure they have clothes, toiletry, that we have pet food that we can give them for any dogs or cats. And so I haven't even gotten to that point yet, truthfully. It seems like there's a lot of help here. The National Guard is doing a great job. Our soldiers are. And I've seen some FEMA trailers coming into town. But I do think it is a bit early. And I haven't heard of anything where people are getting placed. People are getting housing right now. So that'd be a great thing if I could hear that, because, you know, it all sounds great. But I haven't seen anything with my own eyes yet.
And Brian, it's hard to imagine, but three of your businesses were destroyed.
Yeah, yes.
Can you talk
it's one
about
property? But
talk about the destruction and what you need, what you need most right now.
Well, right now, like I said, getting those people that lost everything taken care of, temporary housing, any type of relief funds like we did over COVID, anything as far as it's the housing right now at this point. But the destruction down there, I tell you, we just celebrated last year our centennial celebration. 100 years the business has been there. And for it to be gone in the blink of an eye, I tell you, this place, I know it's just a building and it's just work. There's people out there losing their lives. But it really meant something to this island, to this beach. It was a landmark, an icon. We raised money for, last year we did $30,000 for the elementary school in one fundraiser. And just to be such a part of the community, to have so many of my staff members here at this donation site that we just, I don't have a place of business to go to. So I had to do something. I had to get my people together and hopefully end on a positive note here instead of just this last memory being a wasteland. So, you know, we're trying to look forward. We're trying to stay positive. And I really do hope everyone can work together and let's get the funds and everything that we do need down here a little bit quicker.
Well, it's that type of perseverance and strength, I think, that's going to get you, your employees, and your entire community through this. And we were just looking at the images of what was left of your businesses. And we are just so sorry, Brian. Our thoughts are with all of you there. Thank you for sharing story with us. We really do appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. One more time, that donor box link, shuckersfmb.com.
All right. Thank you, Brian.
Thank you so much, guys.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
All right. Well, Hurricane Ian brought with it not only destructive winds, but massive storm surge and flooding as well. And storms with heavy rainfall are likely to continue. That's, of course, due to climate change. With me now to discuss this aspect of this story is Michael Wehner, senior scientist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So I want to talk about your research. Ian, of course, has followed a trend of hurricanes that we've seen drop an increasing amount of rain, larger storm surges. Based on your analysis, what we've read, you found that it was 10% wetter due to climate change. Explain this. How does that work?
Well, we've been studying the effect of climate change, global warming, on storm rainfall for quite a number of years now, especially focusing on hurricanes. And we're routinely finding that climate change supercharges the rain in hurricanes, especially the most strong ones like this horrendous storm of Hurricane Ian. And so our release statement is a rather conservative one, that global warming increased precipitation by more than 10%. We'll do that is based on our previous peer-reviewed studies using the same methods and the same models. We will visit this storm in much greater detail as time goes on. But this statement is important because it really relates directly to the freshwater inland flooding that we saw on TV after the storm had passed. There is no doubt also in my mind that the saltwater flooding from the storm surge and the wind damage, that this is also exacerbated by climate change, although I'm not putting a number on that at this time.
Well, that was what my next question was going to be. Can you just help people understand the impact of actually having a storm that's 10% wetter? Does it mean more flooding? Does it mean more devastation, more destruction?
Oh, absolutely. We haven't done the flooding analysis for Hurricane Ian yet, but we did for Hurricane Harvey. This took quite a bit of time. But we estimated there that climate change increased precipitation by 19%, so a little bit more. But it increased the flood area by 14%. Mm. And that translated to a climate change-induced cost of the storm of an additional $13 billion. And it goes beyond that, in fact, that we found that there were disparities across socioeconomic groups with low-income Hispanic population in Houston during that storm being disproportionately affected.
And so what is your message as it relates to addressing climate change? What specifically would you like to see happen, and how quickly does that need to happen?
It needs to happen immediately. I mean, I think these storms, you know, and Fiona being, you know, only just a few days really before this, demonstrate that dangerous climate change is here now. This is not our grandchildren's problem. It is our problem. And you know, there is no time to waste. We need to act now, both to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels so we can reduce our emissions of carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases, but also to adapt. And that means, you know, like revised building codes and rethinking about, you know, where we rebuild.
Mm. And what is more concerning to you when you think about the bigger hurricanes or even the smaller ones like Fiona that was a Category 1, but still brought with it a lot of force, a lot of rain, a lot of flooding?
Well, one of the things that people often confuse is that, you know, the category, right? Mm-hmm. It is a convenient way of communicating one little bit of the storm, the strongest winds, but it doesn't necessarily convey the danger. And so category one storms or category two storms can be very deadly. Hurricane Sandy was only category two, but by other metrics, it was the second largest hurricane in the Atlantic at any time. And so I think the most important message I would like to impart is that the National Hurricane Center and the National Weather Service are very good at what they do. And when they issue a warning, take that very seriously. If there are evacuation orders in where you live, follow them. Otherwise, you're risking your life unnecessarily.
All right, Michael Wehner, thank you so much. We really appreciate your great information.
Thank you.
Still ahead, still running, we have fresh reaction to the Herschel Walker abortion controversy as we continue to track how this could impact this key midterm race. Plus, women-led protests and demonstrations continue throughout Iran. Students, even some high school-aged, have become the latest voices to join in as the regime crackdown intensifies. You're watching Meet the Press now. Welcome back. We want to turn to politics now. Georgia Republican Senate candidate Herschel Walker, who has campaigned on banning abortion without exceptions, is again denying reporting in the Daily Beast that he allegedly urged his girlfriend to have an abortion in 2009 and sent her a check to cover the cost. Take a listen to what he had to say today.
It's sort of like everyone is anonymous or everyone is leaking and they want you to confess to something you have no clue about, but it just shows how desperate they are right now. They see me as a big threat, and I know that. And I knew it when I got into this race, but they don't realize that. I think they came for the wrong one. They energize me. They energize me because I know how they really want to try to keep this seat.
Now, NBC News has not yet verified the allegations or independently reviewed the documents obtained by the Daily Beast. When reached for comment, Walker's campaign pointed NBC News to his denial of the story and its intention to file suit, which has not happened yet to our knowledge. Walker also responded to videos posted online by his 23-year-old son, Christian, that blasted his father's campaign and called him a bad father, a liar, and a hypocrite.
Well, I love my son unconditionally, and that's the way I've always been. I always love him unconditionally. Well, the damage he's doing is letting people know that the left will do whatever they can to win this seat. And I told you when I got in this race, I'm going to win this seat. People see someone sitting here in front of you right now that's been redeemed, and I want America to know I'm living proof that you can make mistakes and get up and keep going forward.
NBC's Yamiche Alcindor is on the ground in Georgia talking to voters, and NBC's Von Hilliard is out in Arizona following Texas Republican Senator Ted Cruz as he campaigns for candidates ahead of the midterms, now less than 5 weeks away, if you can believe it. Yamiche, let me start with you because you've been talking to folks there in Georgia. What is their reaction so far to this controversy with Herschel Walker? Do you feel like some of his supporters are defecting or are they standing by him?
Well, Kristen, the big question is, how is this October surprise going to impact this tight Senate race here in Georgia? I've been in Marietta, Georgia all day talking to voters. This is a part of the state of Georgia that used to be deeply red, that shifted blue. Take a listen to what voters told me about these allegations that Herschel Walker paid for an abortion. Take a listen.
It doesn't impact my vote in this case. I haven't seen any evidence yet. I prefer people who are principled, who do the things they're advocating. So, but I don't think it'll impact my vote.
I believe it. I don't think she's just making this story up. And I think as we go through it, we'll see. All the facts will come to light. I believe it. The only reason Herschel Walker is on this ballot right now is because he supports Trump. If you support Trump, you can have any kind of morals in this country.
So you heard it, voters with all sorts of different opinions. But the bottom line is, after talking to a number of voters, I get the sense that this isn't really changing people's minds. If you're a voter who didn't like Herschel Walker, and I met many of them, this isn't going to sort of change anything for you. Voters told me that they already thought that he didn't have the character to serve in the U.S. Senate because of the domestic abuse claims that he was facing. But I also talked to some Herschel Walker fans, and they tell me even if this allegation is true, even if he paid a woman who was carrying his child to have an abortion, they will forgive him because everyone, they say, makes mistakes. It's also important to note that some of those people talked to me about Christian Walker, who is the son who is now broken with his father. They told me that they're not really moved by Christian Walker. One person told me children always feel a certain type of way about their parents. So that sort of tells you what people are thinking down here. I'll also say, of course, the National Republican Party has been circling the wagons and is sticking with Herschel Walker. That also echoes what these voters have been telling me.
Well, and that's exactly what our reporting shows, Yamiche. I've been talking to sources who say, look, you have top Republicans who are going to be standing shoulder to shoulder with Herschel Walker. They're going to be campaigning with him in these final weeks of the campaign. And we know that the campaign has been fundraising off of this. They say they had their best day yesterday. They're still trailing behind Raphael Warnock. But at this point in time, the National Republican top Republicans are standing with him. I mean, that's fairly significant.
It is very significant. And there's a source telling NBC News that that Herschel Walker, just in the last few days here, since this story broke in the Daily Beast, that he's raised at least $500,000. And he's talking about the fact that he's a victim. He said that these are all lies, saying that this woman who's making these allegations, that she is part of the left conspiracy to try to stop him from winning this Senate race. That is a tight race. I should also note, though, that the Daily Beast is saying that this woman, that she's anonymous because of privacy concerns, but that they interviewed someone who was a friend who corroborated her story and took care of her after this alleged abortion. So a lot of things going on here. But I will also say one other thing, which is that there's a voter who told me that the Republican Party is somewhat unrecognizable, a critic of Herschel Walker, who said this is really the echoes of the Trump politics, where you had former President Trump, who had all sorts of scandals involving adult film stars, involving multiple children by multiple women. It didn't really matter at the end because he still was able to be the president and is still a very, very popular figure in the Republican Party. That is also what's happening here with Herschel Walker in some voters' minds, Kristen.
Yeah, it's a really great point, Yamiche. The playbook has changed in the post-Trump era. And of course, his challenger, Raphael Warnock, declining really to weigh in directly on this controversy, instead saying, look, I just want to stress that I have consistently supported abortion rights. Juan, let me turn to you. You are in Arizona following another very tight race, conservative candidates, well, let me actually ask you about the race that you've been following, which is, of course, Ted Cruz is there to campaign with Carrie Lake. Talk about this race. And yeah, what are the stakes and what's the impact of having Ted Cruz?
Right. Ted Cruz is on a bus trip around the country where he's making campaign stops. He is landing here in Arizona this afternoon, just about a half hour from now. He will be joining Carrie Lake, the candidate for governor here, but also the likes of Blake Masters, the U.S. Senate campaign. We can get more into his race. But this is a situation in which Carrie Lake is really trying to galvanize Republican voters around the state to come out in support, not only her, but also help boost the like of Blake Masters, inviting him to her campaign events, as well as the likes of Mark Finchem, who is running for Secretary of State, Abe Amade, who is running for Attorney General. So what you've seen on the Democratic side, the Democratic gubernatorial candidate, Katie Hobbs, run independently from Adrian Fontes, who's running for Secretary of State, who's been running independently from Chris Mays, who's been running independently from Mark Kelly for the U.S. Senate. This Republican ticket is trying to unify and win big in what would be a major sweep for Donald Trump, a state that would allow him to make the case heading into 2023 and 2024 that he should be the party's nominee. But you have to look at the reality that in 2020, Donald Trump won here by Donald Trump lost here by about 10,000 votes. Mark Kelly won by about 2.5 percentage points here. These numbers are so close, even in polling here today. That's where, when you look at this at a national perspective, the dynamics nationally, when we're talking about these races being federalized, really have not changed that much. Donald Trump is still very much the face of this Republican Party, and the Republican candidates in the state have stood solely by him and will campaign alongside him here on Sunday. So the question is, could the Dobbs decision, could that pull off just enough voters there to keep this in Democratic hands? Ultimately, there's so many questions here. Well, early voting is slated to begin just 1 week from now, Kristen.
Yeah, and I have to imagine that what's happening in Georgia is getting some reaction there in Arizona, where you are as well, because Republicans really see Georgia as critical to their path to winning the Senate. So what are folks, what's your sense, Vaughn? Because as you just say, abortion right, could be a game changer in some of these races.
You know, and it was Georgia and Nevada that really Republican leaders were looking at as their greatest pickup opportunities. And Blake Masters had really, his campaign had gone down on the totem pole. The NRSC had pulled out, no longer spending money here. Mitch McConnell's, the Senate majority PAC had stopped spending money here, or I should say the Senate Leadership Fund had stopped spending money here. But suddenly, with Georgia really becoming a question mark, there's now a doubling down of whether Blake Masters could become a contender here, or whether it's worth investing resources here. Blake Masters has been hit on the airwaves by a rate of 5-1. I mean, about $50 million has been spent for Mark Kelly, as opposed to about $10 million on behalf of Blake Masters. And the Kelly campaign and allies of his have really hit him on past remarks, suggesting that there should be a federal personhood bill, that there should be a national abortion ban. He at one point called abortions demonic. And so for Blake Masters, he's really put himself here into a corner. And when you're looking at least on the airwave spending, it's a question for Republicans whether it'd be worth reinvesting resources here as he continues to move across the country. Polling would suggest a new CBS poll here today had him down by just 3 percentage points. And that could turn the eyes of some Republicans at a time in which Carrie Lake in that Katie Hobbs governor's race is still neck and neck. And there's a question of whether she could help pull up some of these other candidates across the board, Kristen.
Yeah, and that is why Senator Ted Cruz is doing his part. It was a lot to cover for you, Vaughn and Yamiche, beforehand. Thank you both so much. Really appreciate it. We do have much more ahead. Our panel joins us next. But first, we are following the progress of this afternoon's successful and historic SpaceX rocket launch. The so-called Crew Dragon is currently on the way to the International Space Station. Incredible images there. It was set to launch yesterday, but faced weather delays from Hurricane Ian. The four crew members on board are set to stay at ISS for about 6 months. Notably, NASA mission commander Nicole Mann is the first Native American woman to travel to space. The crew also includes a Russian cosmonaut, proving scientific cooperation in space continues to transcend international tensions on Earth. We'll be right back. Welcome back. With control of the Senate potentially on the line, Republican groups and politicians are largely standing by Herschel Walker after the allegations he funded the abortion of a former girlfriend. As we mentioned, Walker denies those allegations. In a tweet thread this morning, South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham wrote, "He has adamantly denied these allegations and he will be the next senator from Georgia because people are going to vote for what is best for their family." A spokesperson for Senator Graham told NBC News that the South Carolina senator plans to campaign for Walker in the coming weeks. And a source telling NBC News the Walker campaign has raised more than $500,000 since the story came out on Monday. Joining me now to discuss all of this on set is Faz Shakir, former Bernie Sanders campaign manager and current senior advisor to the Vermont senator. Republican strategist Jim Dornan and USA Today Washington Bureau Chief Susan Page. Thanks to all of you for being here. Susan, let me start with you. Open it up. How big of a deal is this? You have top Republican Senator Lindsey Graham on a long list saying, we not only stand by Herschel Walker, we plan to campaign with him.
Well, they don't really have an option. It's too late to replace him on the ballot. If you want to continue to compete in this very close race, it's Herschel Walker or nobody. Now, this can't possibly be helpful to Herschel Walker to have these allegations out there. Right. But what's maybe more stunning is that it may not be crippling for him. We have seen new rules that Donald Trump has brought to politics. So it is possible that he survives.
Well, Jim, weigh in on that point. You have a lot of Republicans comparing this to the Access Hollywood tape, speaking about how things changed in the Trump era. That was a huge scandal that engulfed the Trump campaign at the time. He survived it. And he was emboldened by it, galvanized his supporters around it. Could we see that happen here?
Absolutely. But if the shoe was on the other foot, you'd have cries of hypocrisy coming from the right like crazy right now. And this is also, I mentioned this to Susan earlier, this is why you vet your candidates before you put all your eggs in one basket with them. But I agree with Susan as well that they have to do this right now. It's 5 weeks out and he's the only game in town. And we need that seat if we're going to take control of the Senate.
Faz, how are Democrats viewing this? And strategically speaking, what do you think they should be doing to capitalize on this? Are they doing it? Because Raphael Warnock is saying, look, I'm not going to delve into this. I am going to stress I've long supported abortion rights, though.
Right. Well, so there's a policy issue of abortion, and then there's a fundamental character value of honesty. And I think that that's what this brings to play, is because Herschel Walker is seemingly trying to avoid talking about it in any kind of honest way or reconcile with it. We have a debate coming up in which he'd presumably have to be asked about it directly and try to answer what the hell happened here. But I think it goes to, I think what you will see is the Warnock campaign try to make a campaign out of deceit and dishonesty. I mean, it's one thing to have things that you feel like in your past you were wrong, but can you own up to them? That's part of reconciliation. Did you say, hey, this is what I did and I'm apologetic for it, and here's what happened?
That's part of what was notable about what we heard from Herschel Walker today. He has categorically denied these latest allegations, but he's quite clear that he has made mistakes, Jim, in his past. I mean, you have his son coming out making these very dramatic statements and Herschel Walker saying, I love my son no matter what. Yes, I have made mistakes. And he says now he's quote unquote redeemed. That is his word.
Well, the quote about his son was amazing to me because that was exactly the right thing to say. And yes, he has kind of asked for forgiveness on a couple of the other things. He wasn't exactly honest about those things before this campaign started. As soon as people started digging, they started finding these things out. And, you know, it's, I guess, part of growing into being a candidate. But learning on the job is never a good idea.
Well, and Susan, you also have this specific strategic move by Herschel Walker in these interviews, which is to pivot quite forcefully to what he wants to be talking about. At the top of that list is crime, and Republicans are now really focusing on that issue. Democrats are focused on the issue of abortion, largely. Strategically speaking, do you think that that's something in these closing weeks of the campaign that benefits Herschel Walker, who's quite embattled right now, but these other races that are incredibly tight?
Yeah, crime has proved to be a good issue for Republicans. People are concerned about crime. There's a mixed record on crime, but clearly crime is a growing part problem in a lot of places. And with gas prices easing a little bit, although we'll see if they go back up with this latest action by OPEC, inflation doesn't cut quite as much as it was cutting there for a while. Crime is a big issue, and immigration, I think, the other one. Of the three issues that Republicans most want to talk about, it would be those three.
What we're fighting is this notion that politics is just about entertainment. And that's, I think, what helps people like Carrie Lake and Herschel Walker, as I'm here just to kind of entertain you. And we're fighting this notion. There's deep cynicism with a lot of people who are hurting out there. And they say, what the hell is the government going to do for me? Like, what is Herschel Walker going to do for crime? He's not going to do anything, but he's going to talk about it. We're fighting this notion that say politics means something. You hire and select for people who have competence and know what they're getting into. And I think just on the merits of that test, you've got a candidate who clearly running for Georgia who has no idea. And in fact, is campaigning on, I've had mental health problems. I'm not sure, you know, that I'm all there all the time. And you're like, well, this is a job that requires you to be there all the time.
And I guess the question is, how compelling is this argument on the issue of crime in these closing weeks? Because you're seeing it in the Pennsylvania Senate race against John Fetterman, against Mandela Barnes as well. I mean, Jim, are you confident that this is something that they should be focusing on, particularly when issues like inflation, as Susan's talking about, abortion have become more prominent?
Absolutely. If this is exactly what I would be advising too, because people are home, they're watching the local news. If you were here in D.C. yesterday, you watched the local news, the first six stories on one of the local stations were crime, carjacking, murders, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's what people are seeing every single night. And whereas, yes, there's not a real connection between federal elections and local crime, that's what the Republicans are messaging right now. And actually, I think it's brilliant because it has turned the corner in places like Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. And it very well could in a couple of other states that are not on the radar screen right now.
Some of it self-inflicted by Democrats with the message, defund the police.
Right.
That has been something that Democrats in competitive races have had to deal with over and over again.
Faz, is that a mistake in messaging that continues to haunt Democrats? I mean, the president was very early in his campaign distanced himself from that messaging because he knew it wasn't a winning message.
Right. And that you, I mean, in any good, safe community that prospers and Democrats advocate for economic thriving of communities, you have to have safety, you have to have security. And if once the people start to feel like government, who's, by the way, is supposed to be executor of laws, right, that is your job. You, like, maintain the safety and security of people in this country. Once they start to feel like you may not believe in the critical mission of the job, then, yeah, you got a fundamental problem. So I do think that most Democrats, you know, have to make an argument that I understand that part of the job is providing safety and security for America. But we may disagree on how best to do that, how to allocate dollars and cents so that it is doing that. Yeah. But you got to nail it right on, make people convinced, I am here for your safety and security.
Let's talk a little bit of fundraising. We were talking about Mandela Barnes. He announced, and I'm going to just read this so I don't mess up the numbers, a huge third quarter fundraising haul, $20 million last quarter compared to $2 million the quarter before. Susan, what do you make of these numbers? Is it enough for him to take over Johnson?
Well, money with that Johnson had enabled Republicans to make the case against Mandela Barnes and drive up his negative ratings. And so now money is going to enable Mandela Barnes to respond to that. You know, there is just so much money sloshing around the system now. We've just never seen spending right like this. If you're in a swing state, turn off the TV because all you're going to see are ads for both sides.
Yeah, Jim, we're seeing Dr. Oz in Pennsylvania also bring in some huge numbers, $17 million.
Yeah, I'm amazed. I mean, the Democrats have been outraising us for a couple of cycles now. And I think we've finally realized that we're behind the eight ball on it. And I think that we've done a better job. But, I mean, I tell you what, they're going to have the money at the end. And that may be the difference, especially.
So will you, though?
Well, hopefully now. But I think that, you know, I've been saying this out to you guys before we got here, the unknown factor is Trump. And that money may not have anything to do with, I mean, may not be able to overcome that if on our side. If he creates problems for
candidates. That's such a change in politics over the past 3 or 4 decades, at least during my lifetime. It used to be that people, if you wanted to run for office, Susan, you held events with real people. Mm-hmm. And nowadays, you don't hold events with real people. It is rare that you would do a town hall. And at this point in time, when you see those ads, what it means is like there's an incredible corporate influence, there's incredible influence of large money. And now campaigns, if you want to run for office, it just means, can you raise money to run TV ads? And that's about it. I need to make calls for TV ads. And it makes politics disconnected from real people, which I think is the fundamental problem that we're all dealing with.
All right. Well, on that note, we will leave it. Great discussion. Thanks to all of you for being here, Faz, Jim, and Susan. Really appreciate it. Coming up, the brutal war in Ukraine wages on. Ukrainian forces are making quick advances in the country's south. This is President Putin calls to Russianize education. We will have a full update on all of it next. You're watching Meet the Press now. Welcome back. Russian President Putin has signed legislation formally annexing 4 Ukrainian regions, even as his troops retreat from those same regions. None of the areas Putin is officially claiming are fully under control, Russian control. As Ukraine intensifies its offensive in the east and south, Putin has vowed to, quote, stabilize the situation in those regions. One of those regions includes Zaporizhia, where Russia is now saying the nuclear plant will come under Russian control, though there are few details about what that would mean. As the UN nuclear agency chief heads to Kyiv, followed by a trip to Moscow later this week, experts at the nuclear facility say Ukrainian operators plan to restart one of its 6 reactors. Meanwhile, in Kyiv, an advisor to the mayor has confirmed Russia carried out strikes about 50 miles south of the capital using kamikaze drones supplied to Russia by Iran. NBC News correspondent Erin McLaughlin is in Kharkiv with the very latest.
Hey there. Overnight, President Zelensky saying that they've made incredible gains, freeing some 12 settlements in last week alone, leading to these scenes of jubilation, Ukrainian soldiers hoisting flags, villagers singing the national anthem. But these victories, in the words of one Ukrainian soldier, come at an extremely high price. Devastated villages left behind, the result of Russian occupation, allegations of torture in these villages, allegations of atrocities committed, all of which are now being investigated by Ukrainian prosecutors. This as both sides, both Russia and Ukraine, are vowing to continue with this fight. Today, President Putin signing into law, making it official, the illegal annexation of 4 Ukrainian territories, none of which he has full control over, while President Zelensky is vowing to fight until every single Russian soldier is out of this country. Meanwhile, the United States announcing a new aid package, military aid for Ukraine, $625 million, including 4 additional HIMARS systems, the weapon systems that the Ukrainians credit for turning the tide of this war. Back to you.
Our thanks to Erin McLaughlin for that report. And still ahead, calls for reform in Iran are growing louder with the addition of student voices. We'll have details on the protests and the violent regime crackdown across the country. After this, you're watching Meet the Press Now. Welcome back. Protests in Iran continue to persist more than 2 weeks after the death of Mahsa Amini, the Iranian woman who was arrested for allegedly violating the country's strictly enforced dress code. Even as the Iranian government cracks down on demonstrations, calls for reforms have spread beyond Tehran and particularly into schools and universities. This video that you're seeing right now, shared online by the Center for Human Rights in Iran, shows a group of Iranian girls at a high school chanting while removing their headscarves. NBC News has not been able to independently verify this video. According to Iranian state TV, 41 people have died in the demonstrations, although human rights groups estimate that number to be much higher. Meanwhile, Iran's supreme leader broke his silence on the unrest earlier this week, blaming the United States and Israel for planning the protests. President Biden has condemned the crackdown, saying the U.S. will be imposing costs on perpetrators of violence against peaceful protesters sometime this week. I'm joined now by Jasmine Ramsey, Deputy Director at the Center for Human Rights in Iran. Jasmine, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
So we have seen these protests grow over the past 2 weeks. They're now spreading into schools, into universities. What has your reaction been to witnessing these protests? And do you think that this moment is different?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a really resounding calls for change from all sectors of society. But what's really been different about these protests is that they've really been led by women, not just women, but also young girls and school boys who've taken up the torch in recent days. Students in general all around the country have been protesting against the detention of so many students. We have over 1,200 arrests, many of them students, and Iran is already a country of political prisoners. These prisons are swelling up, and there are fears of torture and killings like we saw in 2009 during mass protests then. That's why it's very important for governments to call for the release of political prisoners and not just treat Iran as a nuclear file. It's questionable to be pursuing the nuclear tract with so much energy while this mass repression is going on in the country that you're dealing with. So there's a lot that can be done. And specifically, we're calling on the U.S. government to convene a session at the U.N. Human Rights Council to express concerns voiced by the UN about lethal and violent force that's being used to repress these protests.
And Jasmine, to follow up with you on that point, President Biden, as I said at the top, said that there would be costs on the perpetrators. What do you think those costs should look like?
Right. So statements of support are great. But again, we really need to move this to the UN. There needs to also be a UN-led inquiry into gross human rights violations. We're talking about armed forces shooting at protesters who are unarmed while they're running away. Reports of children being among the more than 150 that have been so far counted dead. These are gross human rights violations that must be investigated. Failing to call for this now doesn't just greenlight Iran government to continue repressing these protests, but it greenlights governments everywhere as people move to call for social and political change. So we shouldn't be silent. There's a lot that should still be done.
Do you think that there should be more sanctions imposed from the U.S. and from the global community?
Well, sanctions that target the officials should certainly be considered. There needs to be costs on the Iranian government, not sanctions that target the people. But beyond sanctions, we really need to work on a concentrated, united front against what's going on. And that needs to be led through the UN.
I'm wondering if you can respond to what we heard from the supreme leader who blamed these protests on the U.S., on Israel, saying that they planned these protests. What is your reaction to hearing that, and how does that impact a moment like this?
I mean, it's the same MO of the Islamic Republic since its inception, blaming others for its own problems. I would point to an editorial in a hardline newspaper that criticized the government for failing to respond to what's happening on the streets. So there's even acknowledgement within conservative circles that the government is failing here and is deeply unpopular. So Iranians are not just calling for reform. When they say death to the dictator, they're calling for an end to this government, which is a dictatorship. And it's important to amplify these voices. And I would also say to the Iranian government that are making these statements, one group on the ground is unarmed. Those are the civilian protesters. Mm. Another group is armed. They are shooting at these protesters. So to say that it's other states that are, you know, causing these protests, I would say stop shooting at the protesters, listen to the demands, and then see what happens on the ground.
All right. Jasmine Ramsey, thank you so much for bringing your voice to this moment and your perspective. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for covering it.
And thank you for being with us this hour. NBC News Now coverage continues with Hallie Jackson right now.